You can find all those on Apple Pods, on YouTube, wherever you get your ear cracked. I'm on back and check that all out. Great show for you today at WonderCon. How's everybody doing? It's early, right?
Woo!
Good effort. But we got a great panel for you today. Great show for you if you are listening at home. Evelyn, why don't you get us kicked off?
Sure. So we are joined today. We lost a couple of panels. We lost one panel to COVID and one left the past. So we're a slightly smaller group than expected, but we're joined by these two gentlemen. I would like them to briefly introduce themselves.
Tim Sheridan. Hi. Excuse me. Wow. Early. I'm Tim Sheridan. I write TV, movies, comics, things like that.
Rob Gutner.
Rob Gutner also writes TV, movies, comics, things like that.
Hey. It's almost like your experiences are relevant to our subject. I myself was working in film for 25, 30 years before I got the opportunity to write a comic. And I transitioned from I still work in film, but I started writing comics in 2014. This is my 10-year anniversary writing comics. And an irony for me, which we might get to later, is that I kind of couldn't get arrested in film and TV, unlike these guys. Until I started writing comic books, and then somehow that made me easier to hire to write a television show. I don't know, you figure it out. But we're going to talk about that, and I want to talk about, I'm going to ask our panelists, what did you do first, and how did you start to integrate the two? Rob, why don't you kick us off?
I started out as a late night writer. And as you know, when someone says start out, they mean start it out 7 years after starting to try to do something. But
By the way, this is a rare experience where when someone in a panel at WonderCon says I wrote Conan, does not actually mean part
different
of
Conan. There was a lot of driving out and lamentations of women, but that was a different story. So I wrote for late night shows, starting with The Daily Show with starting with Dennis Miller Live, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and then eventually Conan, the gentle, tall guy, O'Brien. And I was doing that for about 20 years, and in the meantime, I was approached by a startup company, which is now an end-up company, I guess you could say, a stop-up. They commissioned the original comic for me, which was my first foray into it. And since then, I've written some graphic novels, and I've also been pursuing freelance animation writing for a couple of shows like Teen Titans Go and Rebirth, Summer Madness, and stuff like that. But I think probably three of us, I kind of go in between the realms, pretty much at random, depending on the market and jobs.
Before we get into Tim, I think that is a really good point, is that so when I got spit into business, it was like you were a screenwriter or you were a comic book writer or whatever. You chose one and you did it. And I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory with a lot of great writers, a lot of great screenwriters. And when we got spit into the business, you know, you could be a screenwriter and you wrote a script, and if it was good, you sold it and you made a living that way. And then all hell broke loose. And you had to sort of scramble, and you had to sort of try to pick up the pieces when everything blew up. And there were a lot of people that were just like, well, I'm a screenwriter. Why would I write a book? Or why would I write a comic book? Or why would I go into animation? Or why would I And there was this time where you had to shift. You had to become a writer of things and not a screenwriter, or you had to become a content producer or whatever it was. You had to create things. And if you did that, you survived and you're still around and you're on panels like this. And if you didn't, at least the people I know that didn't are in Pennsylvania selling insurance or whatever. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think they would rather.
People in Pennsylvania need insurance.
Yeah, I think they'd rather be writing comic books. And I mean,
some of them are in Pittsburgh. They really need insurance.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. We all had to diversify our bonds. I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Tim, what was your path?
I mean, my path is kind of strange. It might piss some people off, actually. But I went to drama school because I was under the
so pretty.
Because I'm so pretty. I was under the I was under the mistaken impression that I was an actor, which people kept telling me when I was younger that, oh yeah, that's what you do. And you know, and I kind of bought it. Although I was writing all the time, I used to do that trick where I told myself I couldn't be a writer because other people do that. Other people do it better, you know. And so I toiled in obscurity and I couldn't make a career in anything, in theater or on screen or anything like that. But I finally found my way into television. The first TV writing job I had was in animation, on a show called, I got two gigs at the same time with the same showrunner, a show called Legend Quest on Netflix, which is a great little supernatural family show. And then also a show called Justice League Action. And Jim Crane was running both of those shows, and he hired me. And that opened up the window into the world of IP for me. And so mostly what I have done is work with IP. So it's odd to me when I get called, because when I transition to comics, I'll play about that in a second, they refer to you as a creator, and I always feel a little bit like it's stolen valor, because I just don't know that there's, I mean, yes, there's a form of creation that you're doing, but
it's still creation.
You're standing on the shoulders of giants and stories and mythologies that have been.
I would argue that even when you're not doing the IP, you're still standing.
I hate to be uninitiated intellectual property. It's, if you're, there is this thing called Cobra Kai, and you get hired to write the Cobra Kai comic book or the Cobra Kai novelization.
I pitched on the Cobra Kai animated series that I don't think is happening.
Oh, that's
right. So comics happened for me because I've done some work in with DC and Warner Brothers. I worked on a few shows. I also worked on Teen Titans Go, Superhero Girls. I did some movies. I did Reign of the Superman, The Long Halloween, Man of Tomorrow. And Dan DiDio, who was publishing DC Comics, wanted to bring in a bunch of TV writers to work on a new initiative at DC called 5G, which was actually a lot cooler than people know. Like, it was actually kind of good. And that was what opened the door for me. That initiative didn't happen, but another thing happened for me. And then I just kind of started doing that. And at the same time, I started doing stuff with Dark Horse as well. So it wasn't out of necessity that I diversified necessarily. It was sort of, I came in at a time when it was sort of a natural thing to move around between them. Certainly when it came to IP, intellectual property, because I was familiar with DC and DC characters. DC wanted to have me work on some of their stuff.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting you say that, because I think the first comics job I got, I wrote a screenplay that was financed and ready to shoot in November of 2008. It was going to be financed with the stock market.
Quick, Google it.
Narrator.
Google what happened in October of 2008.
I had a film die because the investors got made off.
Oh, wow.
That was another one that was great.
Yeah, mine didn't get made off. They just literally oh, those stocks I was going to sell to make your movie are apparently worthless now. So that's not going to happen. But it was a really good script by using it myself. And a colleague read it and said, wow, you're a really great writer. I can't help you. But I know a comic book editor that might be willing to hire you to write something. And it was for Dynamite, which is the fifth or sixth biggest company. And at the time, they had a lot of 1930s pulp adventure IP. and my father was a Pulp Fiction writer, and I think a little unique for someone my age, I was raised with Doc Savage and The Shadow and all of that, so I think they felt, you know, I actually said to him, you don't want someone to write Doc Savage who doesn't have to read the Wikipedia page to do it. I'm actually the guy, I've read the books, I know the characters. And he was like, yeah, that is odd. As an aside, the only time I've ever been a guest of honor at a convention, I was in 2017, the guest of honor at the Doc Savage convention. My wife is 3 years younger than me. I was probably 47 at the time. She was the youngest person in the room by decades. Like, aside from me, I was like 75. And that's great. It was actually a really great, fun time. But all that said, I do think that it's interesting that you bring that up. I think my familiarity with the IP they were currently doing was helpful. And I will say, one of the great things about working in IP as a professional is it validates your entire life as a nerd. Because someone says to you, someone a couple of years ago, I wrote, someone asked me, do you want to write Gulliver on Mars? And I said, I actually know who that is. I've actually read that terrible, terrible book. And yeah, I do want to write. Gulliver on Mars was a thing that came out a little bit before John Carter of Mars. And some people think John Carter's ripoff of it. It really isn't. And it's not a good book, but it's got some intriguing premises in it that you can jump off of. But all that to say, like, I was like, oh, good, it was worthwhile reading that terrible pulp novel from 1895, apparently.
I mean, it is funny, like, I was a DC kid. I grew up, only read DC Comics exclusively. It was my life. I collect action figures, and only collect DC action figures. And then I got a job for DC. Part of it was because I just knew inside and out.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to call Mark Waid, you know, Superman.
Although I still do. I
mean, yeah, sure. And Rylan, why don't you tell us your path to comics?
Yeah, my path. I mean, this IP connection is really interesting. It's maybe not what I would have sort of attached to right now, but there's this rhythm here, and not something I talk about too much. So, yeah, let's go back to 2008. Let me take you back to the year 2008. Do it in an Heston voice. I'm going to speak the rest of the panel in the Heston voice. again, I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory, and we all got spit out into the job market. And you had an idea, you wrote a script, it was good, you sold it. And you kept going like that. I had a good couple of years doing that. And then this financial crisis that Eleni was talking about happened right around 2008. That coincided with the last writer's strike.
Great time.
And everything blew up. Hollywood used the whole fiasco as a way to kind of, as an excuse to sort of completely remake the way they did business. Suddenly, like overnight, they were making about a third as many films. A lot less opportunity. What this coincided with, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not so coincidentally, was the IP revolution, right? We went from, it was the end of this period of time where original ideas really died, and the beginning of this era where everything needed to be based on something, a book, a comic book, a video game.
And I want to step in and say, the thing, the IP didn't even need to be successful.
Yeah.
It just, Men in Black was a black and white comic book that nobody read. It just had a great title and one great image, an intriguing premise. I mean, you read those comic books and you're kind of stunned that a billion-dollar franchise came out of this rag. But, you know, God bless it. That's so even just being able to point to the thing and saying, it's partially executive cowardice.
Yeah.
It is not, this guy wrote this great script, I want to make it. It's someone else thought this was good. You don't have to stand there alone and say, no, I read this spec script and I really liked it and the writer's good and all that. You get to say, well, a publisher thought this was valid. So yeah. Can we all...
I think the industry term is cover your ass.
Yeah, cover your ass.
Yeah. I mean, success is... success. There are different kinds of successes also. I mean, I remember sitting, you know, with Tony Kramitz, who was the producer of 24. I had this comic book ad that was often described as 24 with superheroes. And so it's no coincidence that he was the guy that wanted to option it as a TV series, but he sold this thing.
and it's he's looking for it. He's like, this looks and feels like a TV show. I can see it, and so that helped him do that. So,
yes,
so
that's why we drew the pictures for you.
Yeah, that's why we drew the pictures. But yeah, so this IP revolution happens, and as I sort of hinted at before, it's like it killed a lot of people. There were I went to, you know, and I grew up during the Sundance movement. I saw Pulp Fiction. I said, I want to do that. I went to AFI and I got my snooty filmmaker education. AFI was where like David Lynch went and Darren Aronofsky, and I thought it was going to be David Lynch and Aronofsky. And so, but by the time I got spit in the workforce, you know, there was no room for the new the next David Lynch's. And so all of these very snooty David Lynch's that I went to AFI with, like, they were struggling. They had no idea what to do. What do you mean you don't want to fund my passion project, my quirky fit of this or whatever? And so I watched a lot of really talented people that were much more talented than me, kind of fizzle out and have to do something else. And I was close. I had a couple of lean years, but I somehow, you know, just sort of bit and clawed and stayed afloat. And at some point it kind of hit me in the shower. I was like, well, I don't know if they want IP, like, why don't I just give them IP? You know, like, I have all these stories I want to tell. I'm sitting around waiting for permission from, like, the five, you know, 50-year-old white guys in Hollywood to tell my story. And, you know, well, like, I'm stuck in this frame of mind, like, I can only tell my story as a film or as a TV show or whatever. It was a weird and bad place to be, and I'm like, well, there are 8 million other ways I can tell a story. I could tell it a different way. A book or a short story or a comic book is very different from a film or a TV show, but why don't I just start telling stories? And if they want IP, let me just give them IP. And so in an instant, I became a writer of things and not just a screenwriter. And so I had an invitation. There was a website at that point called Popcorn Fiction, and it was a guy named Derek Haas, who wrote a lot of great movies. He wrote Wanted, and he wrote 310 to Yuma. He is best known now for creating all of the Chicago TV series, Chicago Fire. He's just printing money now with Dick Wolf, so he doesn't talk to me anymore. But we shared a manager, and he was shooting a movie in Ann Arbor, where I went to college. I was back to visiting him on set, and courted me on set, and he's like, I got this website going, why don't you, you know, do a short story. And for the longest time, I was like, why would I want to write a short story? And you know, I'm a screenwriter. And you know, then the stars aligned. And so I wrote this short story. It was based on an idea that I would have written as a spec script or pitched around town and not sold. And I wrote it as a short story, and it was about Popcorn Fiction, and like overnight, we had a bidding war on it. And we had Justin Lin on one side, coming off of Fast Six. Might still be the largest summer opening in Universal history. Great time to be in business with him. And then we had Brett Ratner and Robert Zero on the other side. And we had Tyler Perry came off the top rope with an offer, which was really cool. We got to hang out with him for a little bit. And had a lot of other people interested. It was this like wave, you know? And so we sold the short story. They paid me to turn it into a movie, all these things. That was really cool. And then we were in business, and I was kind of like, well, this worked. And my agents are like, this was a fluke. It's not a fluke, I promise you. I promise you this is where things are headed. I was a visionary, see? And they're like, no, just write the next spec. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And so, short and sweet, like, I did that again with short stories probably 6 or 7 times since then. Started writing comic books. My first comic book, Aberrant, was optioned for TV 2 weeks before the second issue hit. Hit comic shops. I just sold a TV series that is close to full go, and that was based on a short story I wrote. Sold short stories to Ridley Scott, and like I said, Justin Lin, and got to get digs on something now. It has just been an interesting way to do business now. I do write on some other people's IP, but my main business is I create IP. And if it becomes a film or a TV show, great. If it doesn't, I don't really care because I've written great books and great comic books. And
I get the question a lot because I've made transition between film and comics. A lot of screenwriters, particularly during the strike, the most recent strike, were like, well, I've got this script and I can't do anything with it. Should I make a graphic novel? And I always say the same thing. Do you actually like comic books? Do you read them? Do you like graphic novels? If all it ever is a graphic novel or a comic book, are you going to still love it? If your son doesn't grow up to be a doctor, are you still going to love him? Does he have to make $300,000 a year? So, and if they say no, I say, don't spend months of your life and possibly $5,000 to $30,000 making a brochure for a television show. Don't do it. You know, Aberrant is something you love doing as a comic book, whether or not anyone ever filmed it. It's still a great comic book.
If you pick it up, it's very obviously a comic book.
And so that's the, and the thing that I found in comics, and I think you guys have too, is the financial stakes are so low for the companies that you have a greater degree of creative freedom. And in the present world with things like Kickstarter, you can have complete creative freedom. Yeah. If you develop any kind of following out in the world, the bar is pretty low to create one 20-page comic book. And particularly if you can take on an artist who believes in you and has faith in you, you can become partners in a thing and make it for little to no money if everyone is putting sweat equity into it. And obviously you don't want to go that well too many times, but you know, artists will take a chance on you if they think your work is going to get seen and going to get out there. You know?
Yeah. And if you're writing prose, doesn't cost you anything.
Doesn't cost
you anything. You have to love doing that. I mean, see, I'm a crappy guy. Like my dream actually is to live out in the woods, write 2 novels a year, and not have to deal with anybody. Mm-hmm. So I'm trending in that direction. You guys may never see me again after this. Things go how I hope they go. You gotta love doing it. You're gonna spend a lot of time doing this stuff if you decide to commit to it. But here's the thing: is I spent a lot of years writing movies that didn't get made. Right? I came out to make studio art films. They stopped making studio art films. I got pigeonholed in this weird way of doing big bad action movies, which I also love. I mean, it can be Die Hard any day of the week. I'm not trying to not that studio. There are these two sides of me. But when you write like $250 million movies, like very few of those get made. So I wrote a lot of movies that didn't get made, and that was devastating to me. I wrote my first comic script. I handed it to an artist, and about 4 days later, I had a completed page back in my hands. And it was such a goddamn revelation. I cried probably 4 times in my life. I cried when I got my first comic page. It is a thing. It is a religious experience. You created something that then came to life. It is so very hard for that to happen when you're writing movies or TV shows.
I used to call it the cocktail party problem. Yeah. A lot of screenwriters that I know who were very successful.
Yeah.
Like, have huge houses in Beverly Hills, quit, and do something else and left town because at a cocktail party someone asked them, hey, what do you do? Oh, I'm a screenwriter. Oh, have I seen anything you've made? And you go like, well, no. A lot of filmmakers you heard of have paid me a lot of money to write things that they then decided they did not want to shoot. And I bought this house, but there's not a single frame of exposed film out there that's anything I ever wrote. And with a comic book, you write a comic book and 20 days later, oh, hey, here is the thing itself.
Yeah.
And in 3 months, it's going to be in a store where anyone can walk in off the shelf and buy it.
And the screenwriting thing becomes so complex because it's like sometimes there are, you know, Michael Bay movie that like 20 people have written on it, right?
Yeah.
And so I spent a good portion of my career polishing other people's terms, right? And so I have made some really bad movies, slightly less tolerable. I have made some pretty good movies, a little bit better. But my name's not on it. And so what do you do? It's like, well, have you seen movie X? You know, about 43 minutes in, Kevin Bacon walks in, and he says, you know, hey, what up, guys, you know? Yeah, that was my line. That's me right there. Kevin didn't say that before. Kevin walked in and said, like, you know, hey, anybody want a peanut? And it was kind of falling flat in the table read. I swooped in.
Yeah.
I dropped that.
No, there is a guy, and I'm not gonna, you can ask me after the panel, so I'm not saying it in the live microphone. I know a guy who is part, who has a credit on an iconic movie from 1990. He appears at conventions, I think he's at this one, talking about that movie as the sole representative of, let me tell you about the making of famous movie you've all heard of. He contributed one line of dialogue to the movie. I know this for a fact.
Yeah.
And he goes to conventions all over the world as the representative of this piece of IP. It's a good line, I grant you, but it's his own line in the movie. He presents himself as the screenwriter of it. And P.S. it is a comic book adaptation. So, like, also, there was less creation of characters and situations. But I do want to ask our panelists, going between the two, was it hard to learn the new format? What was the adaptation from writing film to writing comics?
I found it, you know, it was interesting. It's such a gear shift for me. I think I've talked about this in the podcast with you guys a little bit, but like the way you think of time when you write a script, a comic script, as opposed to a TV script. Well, I mean, first of all, I wrote for late nights. It was like you wrote something and it kind of goes on the air exactly like that, like you wrote it in real time, except cut off by 2 minutes for commercials. But and that's almost like the purest form, you know, TV and movies get extensively rewritten. So like I went from that into comics, and I started having to rethink about time, like how much time passes in each panel, how much information you have to do, and also how you don't have too much so it starts to lag. The page turn we talked about as well, like you want to have something compelling at the end of it. If it's a real like a physical comic, the right hand. I think the recto page, the right hand bottom thing, before you turn the page, you gotta have something that people see, completely rethink about structure in that way in terms of moments, small moments and big moments. And for me, it's really cool when I get into it, but it's like my brain, like I have to shift to a completely different gear that somewhat procrastination happens. Like I was writing my first comic while I was also writing monologue jokes for Conan. And so like, I would get my monologue jokes done early and have some downtime. You think, hey, I'll just go write the comic book now. But it's like, hey, what's on Facebook? Hey, there's a cool article, because my brain just didn't want to move over. And finally, I didn't want to leave. I was like, oh, this is amazing. I love the way that this flows. This is so cool. I don't want to leave this, but it was a really wrenching thing for me to kind of go in between those things.
And did you do any, like you mentioned page turns, which is the thing I'm obsessed with.
Yeah.
The pacing of a comic book, that literally every two pages, you have to come up with a reason for them to turn the page. And it can be as simple as question ask, question answer. It can be, oh my God, what's that? Burn the tablet, and you know, it's a monster, change the page. So it can be micro and it can be macro, but you have to propel the reader through the comic. And I read comics from screenwriters and go, they don't know that. That pacing doesn't exist in this comic.
Which is funny because it's a lot like what we do in television with, you know, the five act even six or seven acts structure, where before, if for broadcast, before every commercial break, you know, where you're kind of giving a reason to come back. We learned that, I told you I went to drama school, we learned that in drama school, which is you have to, at the end of act one, you have to give the audience a reason to come back after intermission.
Yeah. And by the way,
they get up and leave.
I miss intermissions in movies so much because of the intermission. I've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey about three times with packed audiences. The gasp when that intermission card comes up, when you've just realized that Hal is going to murder the astronauts. And then you've got to stand in the lobby of spoilers, 1969. And then you have to stand in the lobby with your friends for 5 minutes waiting for, we're going to go back in there and he's going to kill Gary Lockwood. I know it's going to happen. And that tension of that. Like I said, it gets an involuntary laugh and a gasp, like an intermission. You know, it's the only time I've ever seen an intermission art used as a jump scare.
But I think it's really different from, I mean, it's the same as what Tim's saying, but also it's like, it's a micro version of that.
Like you said, the pacing is so different. When it's only a two pages, right? It's your act.
Yeah, like a sitcom, the shortest sitcom, it's probably like 8 or 10 pages.
Yeah.
Like the smallest one where you have to have something.
Yeah.
This, you have to have something, but I think it can be lower stakes. That's too.
Question.
An act break in a film or TV is like, you know, is the person going to achieve their goal of their entire story? This is like,
someone's behind the door, or like, what the hell is that? Or
it's a lot like a horror movie.
It's like,
oh, I hear a creep down the hallway. Let me creep down the hallway. You know, what's behind the door?
I can say anything about writing comics. It's a lot like a horror movie.
There you go.
That's just the paycheck.
Tim is the final girl.
The thing you said about time is really interesting, because Howard Chaykin does some pretty good podcasts and lectures on comic books. And I was listening to him once, we were talking, and I said, it's literally the only medium in which, and this is some Einstein shit for you, space equals time. The size of the panel is a unit of time. The amount of words in the panel are the amount of time you're gonna spend looking at the panel. The amount of detail, visual detail in a panel, is going to make you look at it for 2 seconds, or it's going to make you look at it for 20 seconds. And mastering that is the most interesting part to me of writing comic books. But no, I want them to slow down and take this all in. I wrote a comic that took place in hell, and every issue, pages 2 and 3, the first open and spread, was a 2-page panorama of a new vista of hell, and partially because telling hell is vast, and I wanted the audience for the rest of the book are 5 panel pages, but for that moment I want them to go, right, this is huge, you know.
Hell is vast. Yeah. Happy Easter.
Yeah.
One takeaway today is hell.
Yeah.
He is risen.
But it's all about taking time and breaking it up in interesting ways. And I've noticed an interesting thing. A lot of the cartoonist style in the industry, if you don't know, cartoonist isn't what it sounds like. A cartoonist is simply someone who writes and draws. There are writers, there are artists, there are cartoonists. And cartoonists, guys like Chaykin, guys like Eastman, guys like Walt Simonson, those are the people who will give you a page with 20 panels on it. But as a writer, you don't want to be handing an artist a page with 20 panels. Like, no, draw all of these things, very small. But the people who are writing their own material are like, I can do that, and that's going to be really impressive, so I'm going to do that. And Eastman in particular, like in the ninja fights in Turtles, loves breaking down time. Loves, like, here's a hand pulling a sword out of the scabbard. Sword going through the game. Like, what I would do in one panel of a guy swinging his sword at a guy, he wants 8 panels of every part of that. And that's also breaking up time. In a movie, it's 1,000 insert shots. It's 1,000 cutaways.
I did, so this book I've been doing right now, Alan Scott for DC, we did a 6-page prologue on ramp story in an anthology that came out before the first issue. And this was part of an initiative that Jeff Johns had done and had started at DC called the New Golden Age. So Jeff, at that time, he was still kind of kicking around DC, he saw the pages when they came in before they were published, and he looked at one of the sequences and he said to me, Tim, what the hell are you doing? There's 18 panels on this page. You can't do that to your artist. What are you thinking? And I said, I promise you, in the script, it's 5 panels.
Yeah, right, the artist volunteered to do that.
But the artist decided he wanted to expand on the time in the moment.
Yeah.
And really give you a lot of different
things. Yeah, the average comic book page is generally 4 to 6 panels. Really, it's 5 panels. And if you're writing something for an artist, you kind of want to give them that. And yeah, you have splash pages for 1 panel or 2 panels, things like that. But the other thing that's really interesting to me is things that are simple in film are complicated in comics and vice versa. One of my early comics had a conversation that two people were having on an external stairway, like a 3-landing stairway. And the artist sent me the pencils with the perspective lines of every step in the staircase. And he said, I want you to think about this page every time you consider setting a scene on a staircase. I was like, that is an absurd amount of work. And in a movie, you go, like, yeah, we'll find a staircase, we'll shoot on it. I did have 3 artists on Twitter once having a conversation about how I had made all of them draw traffic jams and how horrible that was. And one of them, I was like, no. In the script, it says close up of two people in the car and you can see the cars in the back window. I was like, you chose to draw a giant panel with 300 cars in it, man. That is not on me. But sometimes you just don't think about how complicated a certain thing is to draw.
Okay.
I was just saying, one of the great tools available to us in comics, though, that we don't always get to use on screen is omniscient narrator voice and captions. And when I first started writing comics, my editor didn't want any captions in the book. And I was like, hey. Because it's a really great way of covering a lot of information in a short amount of time. Well, if you do it in a movie, if you do it in a TV show, now you've got, it's basically maybe detective noir, you can get away with it.
It isn't, when I started writing comics, coming from film, this is a technique thing, I wrote in a very cinematic style, which was very popular at the time, 10 years ago, where there were no captions, where it was just the sound effects of what you would hear, the dialogue, and what you would hear, that's it, no. And the same artist who told me about the staircase thing was like, let comics be comics, man.
That's
write,
right.
Write a caption, it's okay. I will say though that mostly when I've done captions, I've done, it has been a character narrating it. And the one time I tried to do an omniscient narrator in a Zorro story. It was a Zorro horror story called Swords of Hell. And I wrote the narration in this sort of poetic, flowery, early 19th century style. And I really liked the voice that I created for the narration. It wasn't like an impersonal, authorial voice. It had a thing to it. And then in the fourth issue, Zorro confronts the Tongva Indian goddess of death. And when I started writing that character, I went, that's who's been narrated. It's Tarmalok who's been telling this story about Zorro the whole time, coming out of it. But like, I didn't know that.
I ripped you off in a Masters of the Universe.
Oh, did you?
That exact same thing.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to add one thing also about the adaptation. One thing is also word count. So when you write scripts, you know, sort of like, you know, the sky is the limit. You write as long as the piece of dialogue needs to be. And incidentally, like when I wrote for Conan has sort of a roundabout way of telling a monologue joke. He likes to kind of bring people along once he's done the setup, bring him back in with the punchline that kind of reminds him of the information. With comics, just the size of the speech bubbles, you have to keep it small to keep the pacing going. I follow Peter David, has a great book about writing comic books, which I follow like religiously about, like, he has like word and panel counts, which I sort of follow in the sake of my artist. But you gotta keep it small so you can think about how to write really pithy. And then also, the comic book page is kind of non-linear in a way. With any kind of scripted thing, you're leading the audience along. This is what happens, this is what you see, this is what happens. This is what you hear, this is what you see. Comic books, your eyes can wander all over the page. And sometimes you kind of need to throw some things in there to kind of remind people to bring them back. Remind them what they were doing because they might sort of go, sometimes I'll put the bubble above the bullets and just because of spacing. So you have to sort of think about how people might experience the story differently, especially the sort of ADHD readers like myself. I just think it's just a different way of thinking about how words are expressed and also sort of what the reader experiences.
Yeah, I did a comic that I did adapt from a screenplay of mine once. And the screenplay, it was a very snappy, funny, 6-page dialogue scene. And when I went to do it as a comic, I thought this has to be like 2.5 pages, and I'm going to lose 60% of these great jokes. Because I just, in a comic book scene, that's just too long a scene. It wouldn't have been too long a scene in a TV pilot, because it was the introduction of some important characters. But I like, the 4 pages of it was mostly back and forth banter. And I was like, once I have established the important things that are happening in the scene and the character and gotten in some good jokes, I gotta move on. And I got, you know, and when you, I don't know how you guys do it, but when I outline a comic, when I start from scratch writing a comic, I think a lot of people do this. You say, okay, I've got 20 pages or 22 pages, great. Page 1, page 2, page 3, and you just go, the page is a unit in the same way a scene is a unit sometimes. You just go, okay, page 1 is this, and this happens, page 2, this happens, page 3, and 4 is gonna be this and this. And again, it also helps you because you know even number of pages are the way you improve your punchlines and your surprises, and odd number of pages are the pages that you're setting that up.
You mentioned you did that for TV or film. I never do that. Although I do think about, I do get really concerned about how it, like formatting it so that I don't have a lot of stuff hanging at the bottom of the page that orphans, you know, to the next page.
Sure.
But I sort of get obsessed, but I don't do the thing that you're talking about in TV, which is
odd. They're fence posts in TV and film where it's like, well, you know, by page 5 you kind of want this to have happened, by page 10 you kind of want, you know, just like a general dramatic.
Yeah.
Right around page 30, right?
But in a comic book, you're like, fight scene starts.
Yeah.
This will take 3 pages.
And inevitably, you have to cut it to 2.
Yeah. But comics are real estate, and you literally go like, I have 20 pages. I have 100 panels to tell this story in. Is the thing that's happening important enough for a whole panel? And by the way, you're talking about American comic books. I have a comic that's in talks to be adapted into a manga, and a great Zoom conversation with a translator, with a leading manga writer. And he was very interested in American comics and how you do things. And he said to me through the translator, if you had a scene where a guy's brushing his teeth, how would you do that? And I said, it would be one panel that would look very much like this. And he said, in manga, 6 pages. That guy's gonna brush his teeth for 6 pages. It would be awesome. He's like, but it's good. Like, that's not better or worse. It's just like, we have phone books to fill. We got phone books full of pages to fill with things that are happening. So, if the toothbrushing is important enough to put in the script, I got 5
pages.
Exactly.
I do think it filters back into scripted. Like I said this in the podcast too. Like when I started writing comics, when I went back to when I wrote a pilot, I started thinking about each scene. At the end of it, instead of just like in sitcoms, it's kind of like the end of the scene is a joke, like, that's not what the turkey said, whatever. It's like, but instead, I started thinking about
the finest fake sitcom line
ever. Kevin Bacon comes in and says, what's up? It's a callback, it's usually just a callback to the joke that you planned earlier in the scene. It's not even structural, it's just like, that's the thing we said before. Yeah. But I started thinking after comics, I think, was that what about putting the page turn mentality in the scene? Just like, what about, like, there's something funny? Yes, it's gotta be funny, but also, like, something like, oh, I wonder what happens next. Like, putting a little bit of like intrigue into the end of each scene, and I think that makes a stronger script as well.
I will say, I was a film editor for about 25, 30 years, and I think it definitely helped me write comic books because you think about transitions a lot. You want cool transitions. I'm writing a comic right now called Elvira Meets H.P. Lovecraft, and literally the page I'm on, they have stolen the last copy of the Necronomicon. One of the villains, and I have page one, the last page of the last issue introduced Cthulhu, which is the ultimate page 28 page turn, giant space monster, and then page one of the next issue, I'm not going to resolve that cliffhanger just yet. I'm going to give you one page of setup. Why? So that you can turn to page two and there's Cthulhu again, big. So, but the end of page one, the villain is saying, "I wonder what happened to my book." So that you turn the page and there's Elvira holding the Necronomicon with Cthulhu standing over her. And I think so much of the way I think about transitions from page to page and panel to panel comes from, I would do that in a movie. You know what I mean? Where's my book? Here's the book. Here's what happened to the book. So you're always trying to think of ways, and again, it's all about dragging the reader through the story and getting them excited to chase it. Book, what happened to the book? Oh, there's the book. It's in the hands of a giant space monkey. Yeah, we are running low on time, but Rob, where can people find you and find your work?
Believe it or not, robcunner.com, where I'm selling my new graphic novels.
Don't type the believe it or not part.
It's not Goblins and Other Tasteless Tales. I have a bunch of different kinds of work there, and I'm also on, I guess it's now called X at Apocalypse How. Instagram, like Rob Cumner, also. Believe it or not. No, believe it or not. Don't say that.
This is now going to be so unoriginal, but yeah, I'm on timshowman.com. Thanks a lot, Rob. Stealing that from me.
And you're at the con. Where are you downstairs?
Yeah, I don't know.
E-something?
There you go.
It's Artist Alley.
I'm Artist Alley.
Come
say hi. I'm going to be there right after this.
Is it Comics Experience? Is that the...
Comics Sketch Art.
Comics Sketch Art. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
That's the area.
They have a whole table.
I'll be, after this panel, I'll be at Small Terrace 46 You can find me a lot online at davidabalonifreelance.com.
Oh, boom! Mixing it up.
GoDaddy stinks. I searched for davidabalone.com like 20 years ago and forgot about it. And then when I went to build a website about 10 years ago, they're like, oh, GoDaddy owns that domain.
Well, I had to buy
it. I'm not buying. I'm cheaper.
I'm not buying
davidabalone.com anyway. Because of the unusual name, I'm easy to find on all of the social medias. And Elviren meets HP Lovecraft number 3 will be out in mid-April, and then at the end of April, I have a new comic coming called Drawing Blood, which I co-created with Kevin Eastman, and that's coming from Image Comics.
I am also at robcooker.com. He rents me the back house. It's pretty cool. I own robcooker.com. I don't do anything with it. But I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is RYLENDGRANT. I spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and settled me with it. So now I have to spell it for everybody. But yeah, you'll see everything I'm up to there. You can get copies of Abram and Banjax and fine comic shops, everywhere, Suicide Jockeys, on Amazon, all that stuff. I also have a backer kit shop. If you go to Peacekeepers, is my latest deal. It's a Far West crime drama. If you go to peacekeepers.backerkit.com, you'll find all sorts of great Ryland Grant stuff there, signed stuff. And, good business. Go see it. But thanks for coming out, guys, and have a great time.
And thank you for joining us.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap Hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.